accession number 23438, rail 1.
Shura Shiwag, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Harbin in Manchuria.
Which year was this?
30th of January, 1923. Right.
Could you please give me the background to how you came to be born in Harbin?
My maternal grandfather, to be precise, came to Manchuria, not Harbin, but a town called Tsitsikar, in 1903 with the Russian army. And after the revolution, they didn't go back to Russia. So I was born in Harbin, and then we went to the treaty of port of Tianjin in North China, not far from Peking, where I grew up. And the reason I speak commendable English is because I attended the local English school. And really, I was brought up in Tianjin, which is a treaty port, and in the English concession, which is an extraterritorial enclave run by the British.
Any details about your family background we can record?
My father was a businessman. My mother was a school teacher, but didn't teach after she got married. My uncle was a surgeon. We didn't have a large family. I was the only son.
What kind of business was your father in?
In Russia, he did everything. He prospected and so on. But in Tianjin, things were very rough for the emigre community. And he opened a kind of a food importing business. And then sent for a book on how to build a chocolate factory, and built it with a couple of Chinese mechanics from scratch. So he had a chocolate factory, and that was his career. And my mother didn't do anything particular, but read books and taught me excellent Russian. And I attended an English school, and I took a Cambridge senior school certificate, and which is why I got into, had good results. I got after the war, got into Oxford rather easily, where I read politics, philosophy, and economics.
Which parts of Russia did your mother and father come from?
My mother came from the Ukraine. I think my father came from Irkutsk in Siberia.
What was life like for Russians in that part of the world?
In China. Well, Harbin was culturally a Russian city, because the life force of Harbin was the Far Eastern Railway. And in fact, one of the people who was in the army with me, who now lives in Australia, Andrew Ostrov, his father built that railway and was the head of the man who ran the railway was virtually the head of the administration, and the second head of the administration in Harbin. There was a large Russian community. There was a university, I think. There was an opera house, and such. It was a very cultivated community. Emigre, and the railway was under control until the Russians relinquished it of the new Soviet government. But on the whole, the population was really consisted largely of refugees from the revolution and from the civil war. So there were some very right-wing elements, and on the whole, the mood was anti-Soviet in Harbin. Tianjin, the Russians flocked to the British concession because it was an oasis and a haven of safety and order in China, which was very chaotic at that during those years, overrun by warlords who fought wars with each other, then the Northern Expedition of Chiang Kai-shek, and then a long-running civil war between Chiang Kai-shek and the communists. And then, of course, the Japanese invasion knitted the whole thing together. So the concessions in these treaty ports were islands of safety and security. And the rich Chinese, their ambition was to live there. And the poor Russians, everybody flocked to the concessions because they could be sure of a modicum of safety.
What type of memories have you got of growing up in North China?
Well, Tianjin was a wonderful, wonderful town. And we had a wonderful seaside resort where subsequently all the communist brass used to build villas, used to go to, called Pei Tai Ho. There's a large English community, and athletics was very much to the fore. There were ice skating rinks. It was very, very harsh, cold winters and very hot summers. And there was a lot to do, and of course China was fascinating even to a little boy, and I spoke fluent Chinese, I still do to this day, Mandarin, and I thought that considering that we were in the middle of anarchy, civil war, and a major conflagration started by Japan, one had a very secure, a very happy childhood, and oddly enough this applies to most of the people I know.
Was there any discrimination against you?
No. At first, in places like Shanghai, when suddenly 100,000 Russian refugees arrived or whatever, there was discrimination, but that abated very soon because the Americans and the French and the Italians and the English realized that the Russians were Europeans, and by not going to their help, they were losing face with the Chinese, and so... it took some time, but I think the Russian emigre elements were integrated, into various jobs, and some of them worked for the British police, things like that. Yeah.
What were the names of the educational establishments that you went to?
Well, I used to go to a Russian summer school, but the English school I went to was called the Tinsen Grammar School, and the building still stands, and it's a state of art. School building built in the 20s withstood the famous earthquake, the terrible earthquake. It is now one of the best schools in China, and I visited it recently, a few years ago, and it was a very Oxbridge school. In the upper classes, a lot of the teachers were Oxford, Cambridge, Bailey Oxford, and there were about 340 pupils or 320 pupils, a lot of embassy children. The bulk of the children were English, but there were a lot of foreign children, of every conceivable nationality. The Kyrgyz's a nationality you probably never heard of, called Sarts, S-A-R-T-S. They were a kind of nomadic carpet dealers across Central Asia. They were quite wealthy. But the bulk of the children were English and American, I think, basically.
How old were you when you finished there?
I was 16. And I went to university at 17 in Peking to decide what I wanted to do, and I decided on medicine, and that's when I went to Hong Kong, a fatal trip in my own lifetime, fated trip, rather, and because 3 months after I arrived in Hong Kong to start my studies, the balloon went up.
So you were in Peking for 2 years?
1 year, 1940.
Doing what exactly?
I was deciding what career I would take, so I took... it was a Chinese university, and I spoke fluent Chinese. So I studied subjects that I'm particularly interested in. I studied the history of China, a certain amount of history of Western civilization. We had a German professor who was enormously cultured, broad-spectrum culture, a marvelous Prussian ex-Junker, and he lectured on everything from Russian literature to art. So it was a kind of a foundation course, really, for me, because I was very young. And then I decided to go the medical way, and Hong Kong had a very good medical school.
What was life like in Peking in 1940 or 1939?
Well, the city was magical. It hadn't been modernized. It was exotic. It was magical. It was mystical, and it was utterly, utterly beautiful, and squalid. And China is one country where squalor and beauty can be combined in equal measure and still look good. And my university buildings were next to the Winter Palace, where I could walk in the hills and eat in the terrace restaurants. And though the Japanese were in full occupation, and there was a lot of collaboration which the Japanese encouraged. And its students were, of course, sullen and very deeply anti-Japanese, and many of them met a terrible fate, tortured, killed, etc. Oddly enough, Peking was in good order in 1940, and it was totally under Japanese occupation. The Japanese were rather orderly in what they did. What they did behind the screens, of course, was pretty horrible behind the screens. Yes, they tortured people, and people disappeared, and so on. But so I had an interesting year there.
Was the torture and killing going on whilst you were there?
Yes, yes. There were, people just disappeared because the Japanese suspected them, and they had spies everywhere, particularly in universities, because universities were hotbeds of nationalism, always traditionally have been. And so it was the students who rioted and expressed the real feelings of the Chinese people. And the Chinese always respected scholars and gentlemen, so the students wielded disproportionate power in China, politically.
Did you get into any kind of trouble?
No. Because by that time, my family had Russian passports, Soviet passports, because in 1936, the Russian embassies everywhere in China, Russian consulates, addressed the emigre population, people who fled after revolution but never went back, and said, you're in grave danger because the Japanese are going to conquer China and you have no passports. This was absolutely gospel truth. You have no passports, you'll be at their mercies. Your only security will come from having a passport, a Russian passport. We're declaring an amnesty to everybody, and anybody who wants a Russian passport, born in Russia, will get one. And my family took Russian passports, and a lot of people did, and a lot of people didn't. And the people who didn't were in danger. I mean, some of the, in Harbin particularly, their sons were sent, enrolled into a Russian kind of paramilitary unit, and were sent to guard railways where they were easy prey for Chinese partisans. And many, many people died that way. So, in fact, I got into no trouble at all. And in 1941, in September, after a wonderful, peaceful summer by the seaside, this place called Peitaiho, which appears in the novels of Anne Bridges, who was an English novelist who wrote about Tenzin and about Peking and about a famous book was Peking Picnic and about Peitaiho. I took a train to Shanghai from where I went by boat to Hong Kong.
Did you say to me earlier off the record that at this time you were interested in politics?
I was very interested in politics, yes. I mean you couldn't help it in China. We had wars going around us, and actually we were far better informed. At least our judgment on what was happening in the world was infinitely better than it was in Europe. I mean, we knew the score. History was being written on our hides. And I remember our headmaster always read a local English newspaper, which was very good, which was published by a Yorkshireman, edited by a Yorkshireman whose family I knew very well, and grew up with his son, called Pennell. And he was a very good sort of journalist. I have a book by him upstairs. And so it was it was called the Peking and Tenzin Times, and it was rather modelled on the Times, and it was a very good newspaper. And anybody studying the history of China, this is essential reading, contemporary history of China at the time. And our headmaster used to give us a little talk. He has the newspaper in front of him, it was a daily newspaper, and he used to expound on the situation of the world for the boys of 14 and 15. And one day he came in, and it was the day of Munich agreement. And he said, there won't be any talk today, children, because today I'm ashamed of being an Englishman. And he walked out of the classroom as the day Chamberlain signed the Munich Accord. So we knew what was happening in Europe we knew what evidently what was happening in China, and we knew that the stall cards were gathering. And of course, the German attack on Russia was in 1941. And whatever your political persuasion, apart from a few extremely right-wing lunatics, all Russians supported the Russian resistance, the Russian stand. They didn't have much opportunity to express it. And so the war, even that war, happened while I was still in China. And the war that was brewing all the time in the background was a war between Japan and the West.
So your interest in politics was really in international relations?
Oh yes, yes. I've never been a political person per se. I've never belonged to a party. And I actually, my first 2 or 3 weeks at Oxford put me off organized politics forever, because I kept on being invited by all the political societies at Oxford. You know, the Socialist, the Fabian, the Communist Society, the Vegetarian Society. And I simply saw the parochialism of it all. And because my politics are really have a historical sweep, that's what I'm interested in. And I don't think I ever participated or did anything politically in my life. Perhaps my only political gesture was to fight the war.
Could you be described at that time as either left-wing or right-wing?
Left-wing.
What kind of left-wing politics?
Well, I should say I sympathize with Russia. I hated Nazism. I knew that the writing was on the wall, and I knew the confrontation was coming. And I think my views were of a kind of a exalted romantic kind. I think also those views I held in my teens probably made me the sort of human being I am. I think I owe every decent social and humanitarian impulse in my life to those early days when my political cosmography was being formed, and you know, I was very much on the side of the underdog. I was immensely pro-Chinese. In fact, my politics were formed not by Russian influences; they were formed by Chinese influences. My politics were formed in the crucible of China. There's a war, civil war, everything going on. And China was my reality at the time. I lived in the midst of it. And I was immensely, to this day, I'm pro-Chinese. I love the Chinese people. I grew in their midst. I speak their language fluently. And so that, these things did affect me. And ultimately, it was that which took me into the war.
What happened to you on arrival in Hong Kong?
Well, I went straight to university, and I was there was quite a substantial number of European students who, you know, left war. China was a war zone throughout. You know, the Japs were everywhere, actually, and so there were Russians, English students, and there's a very good medical faculty, and a man called Sloss, was a great Scottish educationalist. He was the vice chancellor of the university. So I immediately started my studies, chemistry, physics, and biology, and so on. There were a lot of Chinese students doing medicine. But all the European students were not ordered to, but were expected to join a military organization called the Hong Kong Volunteer Defense Corps, which was composed entirely of the civilians, called the HKVDC, or jokingly the Hong Kong VD Corps. So it was like an OTC, in actual fact. And just before the Japanese attack, I went to a summer camp for a week, where I learned in uniform, and I learned how to fire a 303 rifle, a Lewis gun, believe it or not, that was one of the armaments, and Vickers machine gun. And that week gave me some sort of military training and discipline, which was why I was able to fight on the day the Japanese invaded. And so, as a result, I would say about 30 or 40 of my fellow students ended up in the prisoner of war camp with me. And a lot of them still alive and great friends. The chap whose father built the Far Eastern Railway, he lives in Australia. He was in my unit.
What are your next memories?
Sorry?
What are your next memories?
Well, I arrived in Hong Kong. I think it's very, very germane. Hong Kong was in a trance. Hong Kong didn't seem to be aware that the war, major war, was going to engulf it. It was one of the most corrupt places I've ever been to. In the first newspaper I picked up on the front page, an English captain in the English army was caught buggering a boy and tried to commit suicide. His name was Chatty. There were a lot of jokes about him. Two Sikhs were arrested buggering a boy in the Chinese boy in a taxi. There was the Bibi Lau scandal. Bibi Lau was a Chinese courtesan of great charm, and she became the mistress, seduced English wing commander, forgot what his name was, and but she was working on behalf of some crooked, corrupt Chinese building contractors, and through her, through the wing commander, who was in charge of air defenses, they were given the job of building the ARP shelters, bomb shelters. In fact, the materials they used were so inferior that the blocks of stone or whatever it was, cement or concrete, that formed these shelters just fell apart like cheese. The scandal broke. He was arrested, tried, and sentenced. And the corruption, the smell of corruption, colonial decay, was violent in Hong Kong. And over it all was tremendous arrogance and incompetence. And I breathed this atmosphere, and I could see what was happening. And I think on the 8th of December, I was going to my lecture. Oh, yes, the day before the Japanese attack, I remember distinctly going with two of my friends. One was an Indian medical student, and the other was a Burmese, and I still remember his name, Mung Ba Sen. They were lovely guys, highly cultivated. I went and played tennis at the local tennis club, and it was the most beautiful evening. And we were having a drink in the garden, and I heard a few dull thuds from the direction of the new territories of the Chinese mainland. And they were rather disturbing, hearing these thuds. In fact, I knew subsequently that it was the British engineers blowing up the bridges, because the whole thing had become inevitable. And the following morning, I showered, got my books together, and I was going to my lectures, but I heard another few thuds, and I saw the Japanese through the window of my college bombing the airport, the Kaitak airport, where in a few seconds they demolished the entire British Air Force, which consisted of the oldest, the most decrepit planes, things like Brewster Buffaloes, which even in those days were considered to be unairworthy. So that was the British Air Force, and then that was the beginning of the war. Now, in a few minutes, I made my decision. I suddenly realized that I had a moral categorical sort of moral need to make some stand that this war affected me as well as everybody else. That somehow or other, the forces of relative good were arranged against the forces of absolute evil, the Axis. And though I had no right to join the British Army, because with a Russian passport, under Russian law, it was criminal to join, the criminal offense to join the army of another country. I knew that it would terribly affect my parents. I was the only son, and that I also knew that there was no great hope in Hong Kong. I mean, where were you going to go? It's surrounded by the sea. It's an island, a colony. And the Japanese had all the vast armies assembled in the mainland. Sort of mentally tossed a coin on the basis of war in the hand is worth two in the bush. I went and joined the British Army. and within 3 days I was in action.
This is the volunteer defense?
Yes, I just rejoined my unit that I trained with, and it was a very good unit. It was an enormously high standard of education. On the whole, the colony elite was in that unit. I mean, everybody from the colonial secretary to all the magistrates to all the university lecturers to the students. One of the saving graces of my incarceration was that the people I was imprisoned with, you could talk to. And, they had a former, I think, headmaster of Charterhouse. The senior wrangler at Cambridge was a member of my unit. He didn't survive the war. He didn't survive the incarceration. He was a chief mathematician at Cambridge. And called Gould's theorem, and so on. So that was a great saving grace of being in prison, which had no other saving graces. So I joined my unit, and we were billeted in a place called Sheko, which looked out on the sea in a beautiful villa belonging to some Taipan. And this little episode illustrates the total unreality of the people who I was with. The officer in command of my unit suddenly said, "Look, chaps, here are a few sacks. Spread them over the floors. The floors are beautiful parquet, dark stained parquet. So we don't want to damage the parquet." Here we were about to be taken over by the Japanese as part of a major war in the Far East, and the guy was worrying about the parquet.
What was the names of your particular comrades in the unit?
Oh, there were so many. Some of the names are now eluded. Hopkins, Stoker, Bill Stoker, who died recently in his 90s. He was the head of the electricity board. He was the man called Penn, who was shouting "charge," and with his mouth open, and a Japanese bullet penetrated one cheek and came out of the other. Didn't even damage his teeth. He had two little dimples. And then there was Michael Schiller, who's now a retired nuclear engineer in Pasadena, a very dear friend of mine. Ostroumov, who, the chap coming here in September, called Yagolkovsky, who changed his name to Corwin, was a vice president of U.S. Steel, and his brother was a gynecologist in Montana, now dead. A chap called Goodman, who was the former headmaster of Charterhouse, lovely man, classical scholar. Komorski, who became a senior official in the United Nations, was one of my closest friends. He's much older than me, but he was a lovely, lovely guy. Soletsky, as a Pole, who I think was with the spooks out of the war in Hong Kong. And then was a lecturer in Russian economics at Vancouver University, and has written a couple of books on China. A novel. He's written a novel, and I just had a letter from him. He's just written a book of short stories, and he visited me recently here. So we were an interesting crowd.
Sure, she was.